But first, we go back in time.
Decades ago, trees were being clear-cut in Treaty 3 territory in northwestern Ontario. The people of Grassy Narrows say newsprint companies were destroying their land. And so, 20 years ago, several women took action. They started a blockade that eventually forced change. It's an important moment to reflect on because it continues to shape people today. The CBC's Logan Turner brings us the story from Thunder Bay.
It all started one night, two sisters on a drive.
We were just having conversations, you know, about what the future is going to be like.
That's Chrissy Isaacs, thinking back to that cold winter day in 2002.
And while we were talking, driving around, you know, talking about our kids, how they might miss out on being able to hunt and pick berries and knowledge of the land. And as we're talking about that, like a big logging truck went by. And then I remember saying, we have to stop that. And she said, okay, let's do it. And
Chrissy says they picked up a third person with a chainsaw and they went out right then to start this blockade in a good way.
We put tobacco at those trees and we said the reason why we were going to cut that tree down, that we were doing it to stop the logging there because we wanted a future for our children. We wanted them to know the land.
I'm Judy Da Silva from Grassy Narrows First Nation. I'm at the blockade site right now. I was the first person that just started talking to the media on behalf of the people that were at the blockade site.
Judy wasn't in the car that night when the three young people cut down the trees and kicked off what Grassy Narrows calls the longest ongoing blockade in Canada. But she remembers stories from that night with a few extra details.
When we're doing this, three young people, they went in the forest and they went and tried to cut trees down to block the road. And they said the first one went backwards, so it didn't go on the road. The second one went halfways on the road, but then their car broke down. Their way in the forest was in like the end of November, very cold.
Judy says Chrissy's dad drove out to find them. 6 hours later, he found them.
He found them and he helped them. So that was kind of like when Robert Williamson heard this, you know, this is his two daughters. He said, we're starting now. When everybody went home, he's here all alone. And he stopped one of the first logging trucks that are coming up. And by the next day, December 2nd, was when the students came from the school. They heard about this and a whole bunch of them came and they blocked the road with us.
And that was it. The moment Grassy Narrows First Nation officially began their blockade, turning back logging trucks, saying enough is enough. Well, at least that's the origin story most people know and remember. But Judy says the efforts actually started years earlier. Frustration was building.
We had lived with the logging industry our whole lives, you know, like driving behind logging trucks. And, you know, it was just a part of our lives. But then I think it was when the feller buncher started being used, like taking the job of 10 men, the cutting became very rampant and more fast and efficient.
I know our group, like the older group, we kept talking about, you know.
Barbara Phobister remembers that time period well. Some of the women in Grassy Narrows were becoming more concerned throughout the 80s and 90s.
One of the things I remember is my uncle, he's gone now, his name was Moses Land. He talked about now, he said, I went to the place where I usually pick our medicines, he said. And he said, I couldn't find it. He said, it's all like clear cut, like there's nothing left, he said.
Barbara says they were writing letters to government representatives, but didn't feel heard, didn't feel that their rights as First Nation people were being respected. They went to the school to educate their children. They built alliances with groups across Canada and the U.S., getting ready for direct action.
And I think the urgency was that we had received a letter saying that there was going to be like
a new proposed
site where they were going to cut, and it was very close to our land. And so I think that's when the action actually happened, you know.
the blockade was set up. People started turning trucks around. There's video of those early days from David Clement and Thunder Bay Indie Media. It shows an interaction between newsprint company Abitibi Consolidated, Ontario Provincial Police, and blockaders, including school children.
Well, why did you come here
again? I can't do anything. Because I was told to come.
Well, you know just head back where you come from.
We just go where they tell us to go. You know, it's not up to us. We have no control. You understand that?
We don't have control either.
Yeah, like they tell us where to cut the wood and that's where we go.
We don't have control.
But as far as this road goes, I mean, this is Chris. Supposedly crown land.
It's Treaty 3 land.
At first, Judy says there wasn't much at the site near Slant Lake.
So back then, it was just chairs and a tarp to block the wind. And at the time, I remember it was like minus 25, and we'd be still sitting outside late into the night. And our people had made a fire, and then they made a like a table, and people would bring coffee or food, and people just stayed there. We would sing songs.
As time went on, Judy says they learned the loggers were using other roads to keep cutting, so they started something they called roving blockades.
We didn't stay still in one area. Our people started moving around the territory and going to these different logging roads, and that's where they'd cut off the logging trucks.
Photos from the time show people lying on roads, forming human blockades in front of the trucks. But Barbara Fobister remembers also going out to deliver eviction notices.
This one is my favorite memory, you know, it was snowing. You couldn't even see the road. So we started driving and all of a sudden we saw a single track right in the middle of the road. And we said, what is that? You know, who's running on the road? And we kept driving and finally we caught up to this big white wolf. And we were all excited because we said, oh, we're doing the right thing. You know, this wolf is, you know, leading us. And yeah, and so it gave us a little bit of strength, you know.
It was just Barbara, her sister, and a couple others, mostly women, going to a logging camp filled with men, telling them to leave.
We knocked on the trailer and my sister, Roberta, is the one who handed the letter. But when we looked into the trailer, like the camps were all set up comfortably, they had generators, they had satellite dishes, and when they opened the door, the loggers were all sitting there watching hockey, and they were all in their long johns. So it kind of it kind of eased the fear in us. Like it kind of was a comical sight. And anyways, we served them our eviction notice, and all our eviction notices were signed with an X, just like how the treaties were signed. And we handed them the notice and we said, you know, we expect, you know, for you to vacate by tomorrow, like in 24 hours.
The next day, Barbara says they went back and the site was empty. The loggers, gone. Barbara's daughter, Melissa Bunting, remembers those days.
I had a little baby at home, so I wasn't out there with them. But I do remember her sometimes getting phone calls and she'd be like, oh my gosh, really? And Okay, I'll be there. I gotta go. And she would just jump up and leave.
The blockade continued on for years in a similar fashion. By 2008, Grassy Narrow scored a major win. Abitibi ended their logging operations in the Whiskey Jack Forest area around the First Nation. But the pressure has continued throughout the years. And in December 2022, 2 decades later, another major regional sawmill owned by Weyerhaeuser sent a letter to the community saying they won't take any wood from the area without permission from Grassy Narrows. The blockade remains in place, but Melissa says its meaning has changed over the years.
It almost feels like a home now when you go there. It's like a second home. You feel comfortable there. It's a place like where we all gather now for celebrations, like birthdays, or, you know, we go there just to sing. We go there for ceremonies.
There's a wigwam, permanent sleeping quarters, sun dance grounds, and the sacred fire is still there, burning. Chrissy Isaac says there is still a sense of urgency.
It's important that we keep this fight going because every day, you know, there's like these industries that are trying to come in, like with mining and still with the logging. It's so important because we have to make sure, you know, that there's something here for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren.
Judy De Silva says this blockade, this place, has become a space for their grandchildren and great-grandchildren to learn about their culture, their identity, and to pass it on.
I would say it's a cultural revitalization. And now there's these young people that never saw the action of the blockade, but they feel the history of it. And a fine example I'll give you is the song Home to Me. It's a song these young people made. And it always brings tears to my eyes because when I hear that song, I feel like they got it. They got the message, even though they weren't born.
This is a place where we love the land. Let's work to show our pride.
That story from Northwestern Ontario came to us from Logan Turner. He's a CBC journalist in Thunder Bay.
I can't go. We learn from the past, now we can grow. We're promised a chance that the plants show. Go big, go far, there are no limits. I wanna see change, so my soul lives it. They cut down the trees while we blow kisses. Defend our home while they dismiss us.
Lipsky.
And I'm Leisha Gorbinski. This song is called Home to Me by Nuijinan artists and includes young people from Grassy Narrows First Nation. You're listening across the country on CBC Radio 1. This is Hindsight.